objective here to carry on a history of some period in the chemical industry or some type of management or some technology?
Not the technology, primarily the management. In this case, we're looking at research and development in the mid-20th century. The factors that we're playing, that we're taking part in it. I have found that the people I've talked to so far, it varies from place to place. What's successful in one setting may not have been successful in another setting. And
Mellencamp was a peculiar situation. I never had any giant chemical research or development, but it was a family affair, and it was pretty dead on its feet until pretty late.
Until you took over. You were the one who made the changes in it, as I understand.
Yeah, that's right. And but it's when you look back at the American industry, this is just a wisp in the sweep of things.
Well, I taught chemistry for 31 years, and I know that when we bought reagents, we bought Mallinckrodt reagents, that we knew we were going to get good materials.
That's a wonderful heritage that company left.
Mallinckrodt AR.
That's where were you in school?
I taught at a liberal arts college, Wilkes University in northern Pennsylvania. I went there for 5 years and ended up, said I'd be there 5 years and ended up being there 30 years.
Very good.
Let me begin then by indicating that today is December 1st, 1994, and this is Jim Boning speaking with Harold Thayer at his home in St. Louis. Actually, I think we're in a suburb of St. Louis, aren't we?
Creve Coeur.
Okay. I know you were born on the 3rd of March, 1912, in Rochester, New York. Could you tell me something about your father, Herbert, and your mother, and their family background?
Well, they both went to the, it's astonishing, to the Kirksville School of Osteopathy, and they graduated after a two-year course in 1901, I think. And my mother came from Pawnee City, Nebraska, and my father from a little town outside Rochester. And it's always astonished me that here were two kids, 20 years old or so, from 1,500 miles apart that wound up in Kirksville, Missouri, in this semi-witchcraft situation, osteopathy, which is a long time ago, and it certainly changed. And then they settled finally in Rochester, New York.
So they went back to your father's hometown. That was he from
near there?
Near there.
Yeah.
And you were an only child, as
That's
I understand.
Right.
What was it like growing up in Rochester?
Well, this was during the Depression. It started in 1929. I remember coming home one night in October and hearing the, I don't know whether this is correct or not now, but city service stock had gone down to $2 a share or something, and it was a shock and a blow. And Eastman Kodak was a big part of Rochester at that time and may still be a very important place there. And it was pretty small. I went to a high school, kindergarten, grammar school, and high school in Rochester, and I left in 1930 to Boston to go to school in New England.
You were, as I understand, you were quite active when you were in high school. You were always busy with some activity.
That's true. Nothing very unusual. I was a shot putter and a member of the school paper, an editor of the school paper, and things of social chairman and one thing another, the class. And that was a hell of a long time ago. Yeah.
Yes, a few years back. You've indicated that your at this time in your life, your mother had an influence on you.
Well, my father died when I was 8 years old.
I see.
And my mother was a real important personality in my life. And I suppose also it was because I was the only child, and there weren't all the diversions, obviously, that there are now. And also, she was a very active person in the field of osteopathy in those days in Rochester. And I guess it was a normal childhood.
Where did you develop an interest in science or engineering?
I don't really know. I remember being involved in making crystal radio sets when I was a Boy Scout, and this was an unbelievable thing in those days, to get music out of the air in a little crystal or galena. And I don't know what that had anything to do with it or not, but my mother heard of MIT, and it turned out to be a good place to be from.
You went there then in 1930?
Yes. I was graduating the class of 34.
How did you finance your... That was the Depression. How was your education financed?
Well, my mother had a little money, and I borrowed a lot of money for tuition, which was $300 a semester in those days, as I remember. And I finally got raised, not finally, but my second or third year was raised to $800 a year. And I worked summers. I traveled across the state of Ohio one summer selling flower seeds. There was a company in Rochester that used to send, maybe still does, send out boxes of seeds, packages of seeds, to drug stores and grocery stores, and then they'd send young fellows out around the country in the summertime to collect the money for the sold seeds and send back the unsold seeds and take an order for the next year. And that was no way to get rich, but I guess I got $60 a month or so. And I must have borrowed some money from MIT, I think. I surely did. And then I started to work for a division of American Cyanamid in 1934.
What was your, what are your remembrances of your education at MIT?
Well, I learned there were a lot of bright people in the world, and I knew that I'd never be a Nobel Prize winner, so I took a combination chemical engineering course and business administration. And a lot of the people that were in my class, as I remember, had been to other schools first, and I was fresh out of high school, and it was quite a jolt to me. But anyway, I graduated. It's a good place to be from.
Well, you've indicated that you had a marketing professor who influenced you with this while you were there.
Yeah, this was a fellow named Elder, and he was just an old shoes, pretty much common sense, and a very bright person, it seemed like to me. And he used to say things that sound sensible and get to the core of the subjects that we were talking about. I remember that at least. And I look back on it, and I was sure a naive kid for the... brilliance of the teachers and the training that we got. And I guess it's probably still that way, probably more so. I think the kids are probably I don't know how to measure this, but a lot brighter than most of us were. I just suppose they had more experiences, had seen more things, heard more things.
Oh, in that respect,
heard about how the people were thinking about running the government and so on, and And in retrospect, it was much more cloistered world, I guess, back in the 30s. And of course, it was pretty hardshipy too. There weren't a lot of jobs. And I've often thought that it's a good thing that there were a lot of people that came along after me that were very active in the 70s and 60s that did things that probably I never would have done because I was too conservative. But these kids that were more imaginative, maybe, or had more insight, were willing to take giant risks that were taken and made for a hell of a lot of progress, as everybody knows, in the 60s and 70s. And it's a good thing it wasn't the people that graduated in the 30s, maybe, that were running things and saw how bad things could get.
How did you combine business and chemical engineering?
Well, it was just a regular course that was given in LAT.
Okay.
It was called Engineering Administration.
Oh, all right.
And there were three categories. One was civil engineering, and one was mechanical, and one was chemical. And my recollection is that perhaps three-quarters of the course that I had were all pieces of the chemical engineering course. But another quarter of it was business administration that had to do with marketing and production and statistics and so on.
So
it's a good combination.
You had decided pretty early on about going into the business side of
it. Right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
How did you hook up with American Cyanamid?
Well, there were, even in those days, 100 years ago, companies would send around interviewers, and there were several that came to MIT, and I was invited to Bonbrook, New Jersey, where the plant was that I went to work in. And I finally took a job with them.
Yeah, but
$90 a month.
$30 more than selling flower seeds.
Just about the same category.
Did you have any other offers, or was that basically your only choice?
Well, there weren't many, and I vaguely remember that I think there was another. I don't remember. Maybe none. I think there was, but I don't know.
Okay. And what was your first assignment there?
Well, they started, for the first time in their career, a technical sales training course. And it really had three pieces to it. The first couple of years were spent in working in literally all of the company's divisions, from the different crafts in the maintenance department up through their production and their laboratories and their accounting department and the sales departments and sales record departments. That lasted for a couple of years. Then there was another year of working in customers' plants. This was a dye stuff manufacturer, and one of the larger consuming districts of dye stuffs was in Clifton and Patterson and Passaic, New Jersey. And I worked in a couple of plants there for a while so that we'd know something about the machinery of the dyeing operation before we got out to sell the goods. And the third step was to get a group and sell dye stuffs for textiles.
Did you have a particular territory you covered?
I was a young kid on the block, and that area I just mentioned of Patterson, Passaic, and there was an old-time salesman there, and he was real good. And then I had a piece of territory that went from New York up the Hudson to Albany and over to Bennington, Vermont, and then west through Amsterdam and Gloversville and down to Binghamton and back around. But I finally came to the conclusion after a couple of years of that I was always en route, 6 hours a day and talking to people 2 hours a day, and it seemed like a waste. And so I went back to MIT to talk to the head of the department I was in, and his secretary, who was a much older woman, that they had requests for people to take jobs around the country, and they recommended I interview a man in New York, and I went to Mallinckrodt as a result of that.
Who did you interview with?
Well, I interviewed with a consultant to the Mallinckrodt company, a man at Sanderson and Porter. I don't know if you ever heard of that engineering company or not. And he was a consultant at Mallinckrodt and had recommended that the company take on 3 or 4 young people out of school in 1934. Good God, that's a long time ago. And this was a good thing that happened to the company. And so 3 or 4 of us went to work, and I moved out to St. Louis in 1939. And that was a training course at Kelco Chemical, which is a division of American Cyanamid. I thought it was pretty bad after a while. It was boring, and I figured I ought to do something constructive. But many years after that, it seemed like, I mean, I was so glad I had the experience of working in the maintenance shops and then getting involved with labor relations, and that was a good thing to have done.
First couple of years at Mallinckrodt, what were you doing?
I was trying to find new places to sell the chemicals they were selling, and some way to increase the sales that the company had. And 1939, then along came the draft and the war, and for a year or so I ran what we called, I think, the War Production Board relationship with Washington. And then in 1942, the company, through friendships of Mr. Mallinckrodt with Arthur Compton and the then president of Harvard, Conant, I guess it was then, we got involved in the Manhattan District in 1942, and then in 1943 I took over the management of that and was with the purification of uranium from then until well, really 1958 or 59, when a large plant was built out here for the Atomic Energy Commission. But during all of that time I was inquisitive and learned a lot about the rest of the business, and some of the things that were going on were awful then and appalling now. When you think that in 1930, just as a, I think this is a correct statistic, Merck and Pfizer and Mallinckrodt all had sales of $9 million in 1930. And both of those companies started in probably Pfizer particularly right during the war and right afterwards with antibiotics and now, as you well know, $1 billion companies, and we did almost nothing until except the Manhattan District thing that I was spent most of my time in, until 1960 and became president of Mallinckrodt. And this was a it's just a happy thing for a lot of different reasons. It was a happy circumstance, so it just seemed to fit me. And it's amazing how certain things happen, and under if those conditions were different, I could have wound up as a bookkeeper someplace, I guess.
Who selected you to be the War Production Board coordinator?
Well, I guess a lot of things happened to me because a lot of the people out there were old, and I mean old. And along came a requirement for somebody that was maybe more of an eager beaver to change and do new things. And I don't know, I guess I hate to use a hackneyed expression, fell into it, but there were obviously a lot of things that needed to get done, the shortage of materials, and then very soon we started to build this first uranium purification plant, and I secured a lot of the construction materials for that, and it just happened.
Somewhere along the line, I understand you also secured a steam engine for power at one of the plants. Were you involved in that?
Yeah. We were short of steam to run one of the plants, and I don't know who got the original idea of getting, and this is in the 40s, I guess, and we got a steam engine and mounted it up on blocks and used that for a while to produce steam. Everybody wonders, I guess, almost about whether or not the United States can do this kind of stuff again or not. It was just, at the time and since then, it's wonderful to think of the things that got done just by energy and quick creativity, I guess.
Is part of that being young and energetic and enthusiastic?
I think probably so. I also think that it was a hell of a crisis. And I think that there was probably a lot more freedom to be able to do things in those days than there is now. There weren't so many questions asked, either by the government or by anybody, and the job got done. When you think of the Manhattan District, it had something, and I'm told at one time, like a quarter of a million people that knew something about what was going on, and was just a well-kept secret. There wouldn't be a chance of that these days, I don't think. If it hadn't been for President Roosevelt and a fellow named General Groves, of whom you may have heard, if there never would have been an atom bomb in this country. And that was two more eager beavers on a big scale. Mm-hmm. And have you been to Oak Ridge and seen all these
in
Hanford, Washington? And
I've been close, but I haven't been there.
Just unbelievable what happened. All these rules that come along about getting to work at 7:30 in the morning and waiting till 8 o'clock comes, and you don't get paid until 8 o'clock, and then retroactivity, the government fixed it up so people collected back wages for sitting around on a bench from 7:30, 8 o'clock, that kind of stuff. Just wasn't thought of in those earlier days. And I think there's a lot to this phrase that I thought some smart fellow from Harvard probably originated, called work ethic, that I never really understood what it meant until the 60s or 70s, I guess. And this is what Roosevelt was criticized so much for, that the attitude seems to have changed, and that awful byproduct now are that I'm told there are three or four generations of people that have never had jobs and have been supported by the government. And if that's true, it's a horrible situation. Although I think keeping all the people in the United States or any unit of geography employed is an insolvable problem. Now this is out of my sphere, maybe anybody's, but it just seems to me as though all the people can produce more than for which all the people can express an economic want. And you remember from your high school economics that an economic want is not only the desire for the goods, but the ability to pay. And I've tried this on a number of people, and nobody believes it, I guess, or very few people do, but it just seems as things get out of whack. And the increasing overhead of taking care of people that can't get jobs, it's not only true in the United States, I guess it went on in Egypt 5,000 years ago, to support all those people, it winds up in chaos. Revolutions. I wonder if that's a true statement.
There's probably some truth to it, at least. But I think we've already passed the point where we have less than half the people supporting the other half.
Is this going to work? And pretty soon the national, well, what the hell?
Let me go back to your Manhattan Project work. You started out there expediting as you had been earlier. That was your original involvement.
Yeah.
How did you go about expediting? How did you find these things that were needed to get the job done?
Just keep at it and at it and ask questions and call people and get a hint and go call somebody else. And that goes on every day in most any activity that works, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a hell of a high priority. We had, I remember, it was AAA, and there was one thing higher than that, but anything the Manhattan District wanted, they got, that was, had any chance of being available.
So you could get doors open very quickly.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And queerly enough, people didn't know what this was all about. That was another thing. I mean, remember, Truman never heard of the atom bomb until he was
right.
The President of the United States, and high up people in the Navy and the Army didn't. I hope the hell this can go on again sometime if it's necessary.
It's an amazing feat. But your uranium production went on from the day the agreement was reached with Edward Mallinckrodt and the government. Until you started producing uranium, was a very short period of time.
Yeah, that was really a remarkable job. Particularly two people at Mallinckrodt did. And this was another example of eager beaverishness. I went to the plant in Jersey City that we had, and I had a lot of equipment yanked out that made mercury oxide. And brought it to St. Louis and put this stuff in, and what do you know, pretty soon, I think it was in April, the contract was signed, and in October there was something like 2,000 pounds a day being produced of damn good stuff.
Well, that went to the pile in Chicago, didn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, yeah.
Because I think that was, what, November, December of that year?
I think
it was
so.
Right after that.
Geez, there were a lot of smart people. From Einstein on down.
When did you first meet Edward Mallinckrodt, Jr.?
You got a few minutes?
Sure. Sure.
I was very unhappy at Mallinckrodt along about 1942, before all this activity started. And I figured this is really a dull, dead place. And in 41. And I tried to get I'd only been there a year or two then. I wrote a report. I'll never forget this, of course. To tell what the company ought to be doing and get prepared for when the war is over. And I sent it to the president and to the a very close associate of Mr. Mallinckrodt's, the head of plant and research operations. And I never heard boo about it. So I changed the name from Mallinckrodt in my story to the Ecochemical Company and sent it. I don't know whether the magazine still exists or not, called Chemical and Metallurgical Engineering. I don't know. It was a big, fat book. It was quite a publication in the 30s, 40s. And I'll be damned, they accepted it, printed it, and paid me $200. I never... And the fellow that was close to Mr. Mallinckrodt in the production and the laboratory operations used to talk every afternoon from about 3:30 till 6, and I was walking by this fellow's office in the laboratory, and he called me in, and there sat Mr. Mallinckrodt, who I hadn't seen before. I don't even, but after a couple of years, you imagine that. And this fellow's name was Farr. And he introduced me as the young fellow who had written this story and had it published in Chemical and Metallurgical Engineering. And Mr. Mallinckrodt looked at me right in the eye and said, "You know, Mr. Sayre, a certain amount of anonymity is a great thing." He said, "Listen." That's the answer to your question. That's how I met him. And then, Jesus, it was 15 years later before I really started to spend time with him and got to know him pretty well. Are we doing what you want to get
yes,
done here?
This is exactly what I'm looking for. Exactly. You stayed in the uranium business, as it were, for some time. I have a quote here that says that you're attributed to you. For a couple of years, the only reason the company showed a profit was because of the uranium division.
That's right. That's right. We had a. It's a sad story. Here's a company. Had been in business 60 or 80 years by then. They had the best reputation in the world for this variable you touched on a while back here of quality. The high quality and the integrity of the people was just high. And they had just backlog of goodwill and a great basis in which to grow. And we were involved early. We were first in this particular part of the operation. And two other plants in the country would go around this technology. And there were three plants, there were three companies, DuPont and Mallinckrodt, a company called Harshaw in Cleveland, and Linde was in Cleveland too. And these three organizations, and really a fourth one, with Linde doing one part of that, had parallel operations, all of them. And we were damn good at it. And this is one of the reasons that we stayed in the business so long after the war. I think that our quality, there wasn't any doubt about our quality always being, these comparisons got made monthly among the three manufacturers. And our quality and our yields, uranium was conserved pretty much at the time, and we had the high quality as well as high yields of the product with very little waste. And then at the end of the war, all the plants were shut down, except ours, I think. And about just before the, and then as late as the 50s, the Atomic Energy Commission came and wanted us to, I'm finally going to get around to your query, build a large plant at Weldon Spring, a refinery. And up until that time, we'd had a fixed-price contract. Now, there's a hell of a difference between a fixed-price contract and a lump sum and a cost plus a fixed fee. And it was a very profitable operation from Allencrod for all during the war and until we got rid of it in 1967, I think it was. And that was a much later. But we built this plant at Weldon Spring, and we went on a fixed on a cost plus a fee business. Up until then, it wasn't only 2 years; it was a number of years that the uranium business had the only made the company make a profit because everything else was losers. And this was that's a true statement that you got there. But that's a long story in answering it, but that's how it happened. And finally, we had something, I guess, like 1,200 people involved at Weldon Spring, and we were getting, instead of making several million dollars, we were on a fee of $700,000. And I guess the Atomic Energy Commission was, they built another plant at Fernald, Ohio, which was a copy of the one that we had at Walden Spring, pretty much. And I guess they were happy to let us out to buy, and we were happy, I was happy, and we used a lot of the people for growing things at home base.
Let's see if I get the dates right here. Well, 1950, you became vice president. So
yeah,
you were still involved with the uranium production. Is that correct?
Yeah, and I had charge of this uranium thing until 1960.
Okay.
And gradually took on other chores around the company.
Who made the appointment as vice president?
Probably a fellow named Mr. Malincrot. But he was pushed into it. I don't mean that wrong. He probably wouldn't have thought of it himself. And by a fellow named Fister, who was president then, and a fellow named McVeigh, who was very close to Mr. Malincrot and an important fellow in the company.
Do you know why they selected you?
Well, what the hell? I was getting older, I guess, and we had a very good record in this uranium business, and then I became very outspoken about the company in meetings, and I remember I got to be a director sometime along there. Maybe that was in 1950 or soon after. That ties in with one of your comments a minute ago here. And the company lost money. I think that's they lost money. And there were 8 people on the board. And I thought, before that board meeting, I had at least two other guys that were going to vote with me. It turned out I didn't. And I wanted not to pay any dividends. All the dividends went to Mr. Malincrot because he practically owned the whole place. And I've often thought this was a turning point in my career at Malincrot when, in front of Mr. Malincrot, I held out, don't pay any dividends. And I said that would do 2 things. It would leave money in the company, but it would also give people around town and in the company a jolt that we got to do something about this situation. And anyway, I lost it and they paid their dividend, but I figured that was Hi, this is Dr. Boning. This is
my
wife, Mrs.
This was a...
I guess that what probably finally happened with Mr. Valancourt was I never got a PhD from Vienna in psychology, but I think that people around him, I don't think really ever told him what was going on. I'm not sure this is right. But he felt alone, I think. And nobody, sometimes guys that were not only the president who was there then, but the fellow before him, Mr. Valancourt would go away for 3 months in the summertime and they'd do stuff that he told them that he didn't approve of before they left. And that's a miserable way to run anything. And I guess that even though he was a quiet, very quiet person, he must have appreciated maybe this outspokenness, although one person told me about 3 years ago that they figured I was probably going to get fired most any time during this period when I talked so much and didn't seem to have anybody on my side. I never will understand this. Because I guess these people thought Mr. Valancourt wouldn't like it and didn't do what they must have known damn well should be done. But anyhow, what the hell?
It's very interesting because you may be right. He recognized something needed to happen, but he couldn't find anybody that was willing to take that on. Had you thought about looking elsewhere for a job?
Oh, hey, yes. And I tried, did some of this, and must have been in the late 40s, maybe early 50s. I'm not sure, but I think it probably was. But that never got very far. I guess something would happen that stimulated my interest again in Valancourt. It just seemed as though something had to happen to that place because of this integrity of the people and the quality of their products. Jesus, they're just, everybody was so honest.
And yet their management was...
Well, Mr. Valancourt was a person, I think, who figured he was going to preserve rather than build on what his father left him. Anyway, it's a sad, sad thing when you think that two companies out of the three that were all in the same competitive business in the 30s and 20s and had two of them made such a giant success of their world. There's a fellow who was a real eager beaver. Did you know the people at Pfizer by any chance? They had a fellow who graduated from Brooklyn Polytechnic Institute in 1934, the same time I graduated from MIT. And he went to Pfizer, and he was a tough little Irishman. And he rebuilt that place. And I guess it was not a conservative place like Valancourt, but it was more like kind of a company.
It was more of a one-product company at one time, wasn't it? I mean, they had a couple things that were their big sellers.
Valancourt had the biggest part of Valancourt was the narcotics business. Merck and Valancourt and a company named New York Quinine were the three licensees in the United States to process opium. And that was, if it hadn't been for that, Valancourt would have failed, I think, down through a number of years. But they still have got an opium business. It's a major part of the business still, not only opium, but the derivatives of opium. I got into what was important to Valancourt, and then in 1970 we had a very bright guy
Ann Holmeyer, who is, he and I eat a dinner once a month with each other. Now, foresaw a shortage of opium, and he was just right as all everything. And he got involved with India and Turkey, and then, have you got a minute here for
sure.
A little story?
Sure.
In the early 70s, whatever these facts are worth, it was felt that a thousand tons of a year of opium that goes into licit, and an equal quantity that goes into illicit uses. And most of the leakage historically come out of Turkey, and some out of India. And when good governments would seize some illicit opium or some going through the country, like a little morphine but primarily opium, they'd seize it and then put it up for public auction. And I took three trips, I guess, around the world. If you look at the map, you'll find out that in the globe, that New Delhi is almost opposite St. Louis. Mm. And if you go one way, you might as well come back the other way to the same distance. And I used to, three times on a trip. And we used to have the Indians over here once in a while. We'd go to New Delhi and Bangkok and Saigon and places where near these illicit uses, countries that used opium illicitly. They'd seize it and then we'd buy it. The English would bid, we'd bid, the Germans would bid. And I got acquainted with a number of the people around the world on that and saw a lot of country. But this was a very important piece of my own craft for years, and I guess it still is.
During that 1 year that you were vice president, did you take on any additional responsibilities? And you were still running the uranium plants?
Well, I started to work more actively with the research laboratories, trying to get some stimulation, and the same as I tried to build my first Intamalacrat. That was never a very fruitful operation. It just didn't have the kinds of people that were inventors and entrepreneurs, and they'd never probably, if we did have any, probably never felt they were given a chance to follow something through. Although it's clear in some respect, Mr. Mallinckrodt was a very good friend of a surgeon at Barnes Hospital named Dr. Evarts Graham, and this happened back in the 30s.
Talking about Graham.
Mr. Mallinckrodt and he worked on the first identification of problem with your gallbladder through a chemical that sought out the gallbladder. And this worked, and it's been working ever since, but with different materials that were less toxic. And we were at one time, and maybe I don't know, we might still are, the major supplier of barium sulfate, which is an inert, innocuous material for globbing up your stomach and the rest of your system. And Mr. Mallinckrodt, it's astonishing. This was a real scientific discovery that he and Graham, and maybe Mr. Graham, Dr. Graham was a prime pusher, I don't know. But this was a success back in the 30s or 40s. And finally there was a research man named Wallingford, and he developed a very successful compound called Uricon for and Conray, which ultimately were used as a major for 20 minutes maybe, for somebody else got a good one too, for identification of blocked arteries. As you know, you feed stuff through the arterial system and take x-rays. And have you ever seen these pictures? Mm-hmm. They're just unbelievable how clear it is where that lump is in your artery. And these were things that, just a spark of research is the only reason I mention this. And it worked, and these products are still working. Not the original products, but changes on them.
But you said that your attempt in that 1 year you were vice president to work with research.
Nothing much happened.
How big an operation did they have?
You mean for
the research?
Well, I'm not sure I'm reliable on this statistic, but I think there were probably 8 or 10 or 12 PhDs and maybe not that many, and helpers, but there was never any definition of a goal or what they were really after. Okay. Finally, this fellow Wallingford developed this very successful x-ray diagnostic medium by himself almost, and just buttering around and keeping at it and did it, and it was great. I'm fortunate.
Were a lot of these people involved in quality control as opposed to doing developmental?
Well, there was nothing really fundamental done, like today goes on in research. Mm-hmm. But they would make compounds that they had some reason to believe would not be toxic. This is just the old-fashioned, which is still going on in a lot of ways, as you know, in health products. Products that people hope will work and do the job, and they, I guess, what, 1-2% of them do.
Mm-hmm. During this time period, I also noted that you spent a few years as a development director. I wasn't sure.
Well, that was the same general period of trying to find out. Mostly, I guess, I worked on trying to get the salesman to sell more stuff that we already had.
Okay.
This wasn't a very creative job. I didn't do much good for anybody in that.
Did you become discouraged during this time period?
I don't think so. Let me see, it would be in the 50s. I think we started the big uranium job at Walden Spring at about 54, 55, and we ran it till 1967, I think. Up until 1960, I was pretty close to it.
Well, in 1960, you became president.
Right.
And was that again had you become closer to Mallinckrodt at this point?
Oh, yeah. Oh, much.
Okay. What kind of relationship did you develop with him?
I think that I told him everything I knew about a situation, and who thought things were good and who thought things were bad. And we would get together every day on something. Well, he was in St. Louis. One interesting story's got nothing much to do with anything except that this fellow McKean that I mentioned earlier at Pfizer called me up one day and said he'd like to have a chat. Well, I come to New York and this office and something, so I went, and he wanted to buy Mallinckrodt. and I assumed that's what the subject was about. And when I came home, Mr. Mockrat said, "Where were you the last couple of days?" And I said, "I was with Mr. McKean at Pfizer." And he said, "What are you doing there, for goodness sakes?" And he said, "I don't know, something else had happened anyway. He was looking for me." And I said, "Well, he wanted to talk about buying Mallinckrodt." And he said, "What?" And I said, "Mr. Mallinckrodt, this will double your net worth or more." He said, "I don't want my net worth doubled."
He said, "Don't waste any time on that."
As I understand, he had one son, but George, was it?
He had three sons.
Three sons.
And they all died violent deaths. Mm. Just the saddest damn thing to think of. Here was a family with all the money they needed and more. And one son wanted to be learn to fly airplanes. And in 1932, he was a freshman or a sophomore at Harvard. And his father forbid him to have anything to do with airplanes, and he crashed into Boston Harbor. And the next son had trouble with drugs, I guess, in the 40s. And George, the person you referred to, is a fellow that I knew pretty well. And after Mr. Mallinckrodt died, he tried to get control of the company, even though Mr. Mallinckrodt had spent from 2 to 4 hours a day with a lawyer in St. Louis trying to design a will that would keep that from happening. Mm. And we never found out whether it was whether it could have happened or not, because after about 4 months of negotiation, he stopped in to see, he flew his own plane. And he stopped in to see his mother and father at Old Forge, New York, where they spent the summer. and it left for Boston, and a storm developed, and he crashed someplace between Boston and Albany, New York. Just so sad to think that they just didn't get along with the dam, the boys with their father, and they had these three violent things happen to each son, and Mrs. Mellencrout was just the nicest person in the world. And very bad.
So your election in 1960 then as president, you were really being groomed by him at that point, is that correct?
I don't really know. It was there was another fellow there that was a doctor in chemistry, and who was very, very close to Mr. Mellencrout for a number of years. In fact, before the Manhattan District, he was the guy that did the first Eager Beaver job on the uranium production that I mentioned, and brought the stuff from Jersey City out here. And he stayed with the Manhattan District until about 1946 or 7 and came back to Mellencrout. And he was by far the closest confidant, I think, that Mr. Mellencrout ever had. But he was not imaginative fellow. I tried to get him, because of his closeness to Mr. Mellencrout, that, geez, it must have been 1947 and 1960 almost, to do the kinds of things that I thought we should do, and either he never understood me, or he didn't think it was a good idea. And anyway, it didn't happen, and he got involved with an unfortunate technical situation where he made some estimates that turned out to be miserable, and the company didn't do very well with that particular project. That was big for Mellencrout.
And yeah. Was that the tantalum?
Well, it was
Colombian problem.
Yep, Colombian tantalum. How'd you ever hear about that?
Well, I read about it someplace, one of the company histories or something.
I think that this fellow was a queer personality, and everybody thought he was going to be president, except me. And finally, Mr. Mellencrout. And he just wasn't a guy that ever should have a job like that. And I don't know whether he was, I don't think he was brilliant technically, by any means. But he was, he was always seemed to be so secretive and have, he would give you the impression he'd whisper, and he talked to Mr. Mellencrout. I think he probably talked down to Mr. Mellencrout, and put little numbers and little squares and three, maybe, I'm not sure this is right. Maybe if he did that, I don't think Mr. Mellencrout would have liked it very much. And then we had this directors meeting 2 or 3 years before that I told you about, and I really don't know what happened, but I got awful specific with Mr. Mellencrout and said, here's what I thought ought to happen and why. Well, there's no use of going through all the horrible details about this, but so Mr. Mellencrout and I had an arrangement. There weren't anything secrets about it. It was just an understanding that I was going to be appointed president. And the president of the corporation couldn't believe it. And he was a very good friend of mine, but he wouldn't stand up and make an argument. He was worse than Gephardt. And he couldn't believe it so much that when this resolution got prepared for the directors' meeting, he had it changed so that this fellow, the everybody thought was going to be president would have more power than he would have had under the arrangement that Mr. Mallinckrodt and I had agreed to. And that's the one that finally got passed. But as soon as it got passed, I don't know, I must have done a lot of things in a hurry. And I think this guy didn't have many people on his side either, because he wasn't a nice guy to people. And I think that after about 6 months or so, or maybe longer than that, I said to this fellow one day, I said, I guess you don't approve of this, these things that are going on. And he said, well, you can't argue with success. And that was a last subject, the last time we ever talked about it in the company. I'll be damned if I know why the company grew so fast, so quickly. But within 5 years, and that isn't assured, I guess it was maybe 7 years, we doubled the sales of the company. And I just don't know why the hell that happened. But maybe a lot of guys went out and did stuff that they always could have done, but never did. And then we made some. Anyway, go ahead.
What vision did you have when you became president and you knew this was most likely coming? What was your vision of what you were going to do for the company?
One of the company problems historically was that everybody ultimately reported to the president. And this was always a wasteful procedure. And it wasn't a big company, but so everybody had somebody else to blame except the president. And there was no responsibility down the line. So what I wanted to do was whack the company into three pieces. And one was our analytical reagent business, that bottled stuff. And another one was the medicinal chemicals. And another one, I guess it was four pieces, and another one was I guess three is right, industrial, medicinal, and analytical reagents. And then these guys would go out and have, and that was a confined, and this worked. And we seemed to gain more prestige at meetings, and our sales started to go up, and there were just a bunch of guys around that were real good people. And the only explanation I can make, as I mentioned, was that it wasn't a miracle. It just they went out and did what they would have liked to do any time, maybe. Anyway, that worked.
But you gave them the freedom to do that.
I think that was a major variable. I think. Of course, I also was criticized for picking into everybody's business. Later, as time went along, one of the major things that I also wanted to do was to grow in the pharmaceutical business, and the company was very concerned about insulting our major customers, because our major customers were people like Lilly and Park Davis and Merck and so on in the industry, pharmaceutical industry. And my position was that we had a niche, and that was diagnostic materials. There's a couple of which I subscribed. Then radiopharmaceuticals came along. In 1966, we bought a company here in St. Louis, and that was the beginning of a whole junior empire. And it's still in existence, and it's grown a lot. And I figured that, Christ, the pharmaceutical industry couldn't give a damn whether we were in the business or not. They wouldn't affect our sales to them because we were so damn little. And we got in the business and developed this niche, and it's still one that the company's engaged on and getting a good position, an increasingly better position. That was a major change that I thought we ought to make, and that got made, and that was a good one. Another thing we were in was we used to think we were great in the photographic chemicals business, and this was because I guess we were early. But when you think of Eastman Chemical, Eastman was just Eastman Kodak, how can we compete? What can we do? Another thing we tried that worked out pretty miserably was that I figured that we had so much experience in handling uranium that we ought to be in the fuel element business as the 50s came along. And we were the first producer of fuel elements for the first nuclear submarine. That was a claim to fame we had for a while. And the, I think there was a ship.
The Savannah.
That Eisenhower had made to go around the world showing how smart we were.
The USS Savannah.
Is that the one?
Mm-hmm.
That went away. We made the fuel elements. Another was either, I could never keep them separate, either Commonwealth Edison or Consolidated Edison, that we made the fuel elements for their first nuclear, big time nuclear reactor. And we had a little plant down in a small town here in Missouri that handled the enriched stuff. And I figured that this was no place for little old Mallinckrodt. Jesus, you were General Electric building, not $1 billion in those days, but $100 million electrical generating plants. And here was little old us supplying $500,000 worth of fuel elements. We weren't going to be in that business long and successfully. And we got out of it. I guess there isn't much more to the...
I'm quoting from one of the company histories. It says that you set about quickly coaxing, cajoling, and sometimes muscling the company into the modern era.
Well, Junior, I don't know who said that, but Junior... step was that article I wrote when I first went with a company and doing things like that through the years and getting money to make acquisitions. Mr. Mallinckrodt died in 1966, but before he did, we talk about an acquisition, I have all the damn numbers, columns and graphs and stuff, and the only thing he was interested in are the people honest.
Mm.
And the guy was just so honest and so much integrity, and he didn't care for the trainloads of facts, but he had trust, and if he, that's what was very important to him. And I was, what the hell, he's right.
Mm-hmm.
Then we try to do things of one of the philosophies that I figured we never should buy anybody that if it got into trouble, we couldn't help them get out, technically or sales-wise. And sometimes I guess I was accused of stretching that some, but that was a good, obvious point of view to have. And we also had a very bright guy who was chief financial officer. And he was a real help in a lot of things. He had very good judgment, and we didn't spend money before we had it. And we had one fellow in the company who said, "You got to spend money to make money." And I said, "Well, we used to set up budgets for the year by quarters." And then I would announce at the beginning of the year that we're not going to spend any of our appropriated money for the first quarter until we see whether our sales developed. And this is probably not a very fair thing to do, but it worked. And we had so much reserve, apparently, in unutilized skills in the company that it did work.
Mm.
And that led to we never needed a hell of a lot of money. Maybe that would, but it helped build a good financial record. I don't know what else I can say.
What was your approach to getting these, as you said, these people were probably capable of doing this before. All of a sudden they were able to produce more. What was your approach to getting them to do that? How did you encourage that? What was your philosophy?
I think that I did it unwittingly. I think that I selected, we used to have what was called an operating committee. It was going on for a long time. I was there since the beginning of our 1960s. And they were five or six or seven people that would get together every Monday morning and say anything that popped into their heads that was going to be good for the company, bad for their plans or something. And I think that maybe this was naive as hell of me, but I think there were six or seven people that were real selfless, and that they would take all this conversation and come out of it with a better thing than any one person had to begin with. And I think they did it. They'd give up their own contributions to the original argument if they saw something else happen. And I think that was unwitting on my part. But I think we did the kinds of things that, one way or another, it developed a spirit of what I call selflessness, and maybe that's naive, but it sure as hell got us doing a lot of things with the people on the same team. Another philosophy I used to preach was, I said, look, let's try to understand this thing, whatever the thing was, a project or a project of some sort, expenditure or new business. And let's develop such a sameness in our understanding of what this is all about, so that if somebody asks one of us a question in Paris and another guy in New Orleans, he gets the same answer from two different people on the same subject. And I think this led people to really trying to be a participant, I think, that would byproduct of that, an important byproduct probably.
Yes, I've noted that you were a strong believer in teamwork.
And I think Mr. Mallinckrodt, you used to detect one or two guys that weren't in the, and one of them was at one time a pet of his, and we got rid of him for a guy that was always trying to get himself in a good position, and you're referring to the anti-teamwork. Mm-hmm. You understand anybody that's been through this tells you the things that they think were great, and maybe under any other situation they wouldn't have been. That's a novel thing about this world of ours, and that there are two major schools of management on this, I guess, still. One group of people say that once a manager, always a manager. It doesn't make any difference whether you're a manager of a shoe store or a chemical factory. I just don't agree with this. I think if you don't have a background of pretty good knowledge of whatever the hell it is you're dealing with, you don't know how to evaluate what you hear. But big companies are run by lawyers. Mm-hmm. So I guess it's not always right.
I want to come back to that point. I was at Monsanto this morning, and that topic came up, that today's chemical companies are not run by people who have some technical training and can understand what's going on at a lower level, especially in development areas. That leads me to asking again, now that you're president, What did you do with research and development?
Well, is that in your eye?
Let me
shut this other one here.
Okay.
Maybe you could.
Okay, that's fine.
We at Mount Crat never produced any great innovative accomplishment, I don't think, technically. All of our work in the uranium days, for example, were product improvements. Now, some of it was pretty good, but we never did the kind of stuff that Merck does today, or anywhere near it. Well, most companies don't, for that matter, I guess. But going back to your... is this fellow Shapiro? Did you talk to him?
Not yet.
Mahoney's gone, hasn't he? Physically, or is he still there?
No, I
don't know whether he's still chairman of the board, or is Shapiro chairman of the board now, or...
At Merck?
No, at Monsanto.
Monsanto. No, I don't know.
I think the bigger the company gets, probably the less important it is to have somebody run it that really knows the guts of the business. Probably. I mean, a lawyer can run a company, he doesn't know anything about the technology, but maybe the problems that get to be important in a company that's $18 billion has got not much to do with it. It's more of a financial judgment of people kind of thing than it is knowing enough of what your research department ought to be doing. How do you find this subject divided around your interviews?
I've not heard that thought expressed before. That's a new one. It's very intriguing. Where do the new... How do you nurture, and that was what I was after in your term as president, how do you nurture new ideas? You didn't have much of a base to build from, evidently.
That's right. I'm not sure that... That's right. I think that I'm sure you're an authority on the difference between fundamental research and what goes for research in most organizations, mm-hmm. which probably is mostly product development that people call research. We did some of it in the radiopharmaceutical business, but these were taking scientific proven things and adapting them to something that we understood. I don't think that when you talk about research, I don't know the man. Vangelos, this fellow that made such a success at Merck, who was from Barnes Hospital, from Washington University, as you probably know. Now there's a fellow that probably always guided the principles of their research because he was so damn bright in that field, but he also had many other attributes. The people at Monsanto, did you know Tally Thomas?
No.
Or a fellow named Hochwald,
Sure. We have an interview with Hochwald.
You did have?
Yes.
A long time ago. He used to be a consultant, almost a personal consultant to me.
Okay.
After he retired from Monsanto. Now, he was instrumental, as I understand it, from him at least, in working with Kettering on the... anti-knock compounds, wasn't it? And then at Monsanto with this Roundup or some other agricultural products that they had.
I think it was before Roundup, I think.
Yeah, well, that's with Kettering when he was with Thomas and Hochwald Laboratories in Columbus or wherever it was. But those are real researchers, and Mallinckrodt wasn't big enough to... get close to the real fundamentals of things. And the best we ever did, and I guess this is true still, are developing other people's technologies.
Okay.
Ray Holman, the president, are you going to see any present people at Mallinckrodt?
No.
Or you just get
no.
old worn out people?
We're focusing on those who won awards, and you're the only one from Mallinckrodt that did.
Well, is there anything else that I can...
Well, do you have time constraints?
No.
Okay.
No.
I'm not sure when you said this, but it was very early in your presidency when you... The slogan of 70 by 70. 70 in sales by 1970. How did the company react to that? I think you were only at 30-some at that time.
It turned out that we made that 2 years early, I think, in 1977. And I think that's right, or maybe it was 78. But that's something I really don't understand to this day. We had $35 million worth of sales, and people laughed when we said this, including me, I guess. But it sure worked, and things kept going well. We also seemed to have a knack of being able to get a hold of a young company, like in the radio pharmaceutical business that was started by a fellow named Conacher here in St. Louis, and develop more compounds from that. But we bought that thing when the sales were $2 or $3 million. And before it got sold to Japan, the sales were 120 of just that unit over there, and about half that in Germany. And then we bought a catheter company, which I nearly frightened me to death, up in a little town north of Mechanicsburg, New York State. And their sales were something like $5 million. And I can't imagine me doing a thing like this, but we paid $25 million. I must have been drunk. And the sales now of that organization are over $250 million. And I guess we just fell into a tub of butter a number of times and were able to handle this kind of growth by really getting to understand what was going on. And that was real, those were two or three things that were real lucky in the course of this Conacher purchase here called Nuclear Consultants when it was purchased. It was a blooming industry. It was a new technology. In 1958, I think it started. And now it's accepted and big and growing. What becomes of this kind of information? Somebody wants to study something and then reads this?
It's available for people who, you will have restrictions or the opportunity to determine who can have access to it.
But are these typewritten things then?
Yes, they'll all be transcribed. And you will get a copy to review before.
Who would be interested in this kind of stuff ever?
Well, there are a number of people who are looking at history of science, history of chemistry, company developments. I'm particularly interested in this concept of innovation in an industrial setting. That's why I've been sort of pushing that part of it in our comments.
You know, I know Bill Danforth pretty well. He's the chancellor, maybe you know, of Washington University here in town, and for 20 years and has put Washington University on the map, not only in the medical business, but as a university and endowment-wise and so on. And I don't know, I was arguing with him about something. I guess I was saying, why don't you, when you want to build a department, why don't you go out and get a... What had happened was there were two department heads at the medical school that were entirely unrelated fields that were trying to hire the same guy at the university or someplace in the United States. And I said, Bill, this is a waste. And I said, he says, what do you mean? I said, well, I should think if this one guy here is studying diabetes, he could look up all the great contributors to diabetic technology and go hire some of those guys, and the same with this other. He says, hell, don't you know what a research university is? And I said, I guess not. And he says, it's a collection of buildings where you go out and hire the brightest people you can and let them do their thing. And I figure that's a waste, but anyway. And he cites to the record of Washington University and their association with six or eight Nobel Prize winners at various stages of their career. But if you believe that, you'll run things differently than if you think you're working for Merck.
Well, the university doesn't have stockholders to answer to.
That's right. Are they, don't see
Rose? No, I'm heading back tonight.
Have you seen many people here?
Just John Franz at Monsanto.
What's been his history at the company? Has he been in technology or
his whole career? And it's interesting because he fits exactly in the mold of what Danforth said. He said, I wanted to do my research and I wanted to be alone. He was one of these people who didn't feel he could ever be successful in a team approach. He wanted to be creative and innovative, but he wanted to be in his own mind, his own work.
And what led you to him?
He won the Perkin Medal.
And he was, that's yearly, isn't it?
Yes. He won that for his discovery for Roundup. So his approach, that's one of the things that's been intriguing in the people I've talked to so far, is that everyone is different, but successful.
That's why I started out our talk by saying, or said sometime here, that there's no one glued in bunch of characteristics. Mm-hmm. It depends so much on your surroundings. It depends on the attitudes of the people. It depends whether or not the organization is ready for something. Whatever I had probably wouldn't have been worth a damn at some company like DuPont, where they're dripping with a history of successes and technological developments. And then a story about whether or not a company head ought to be able to tell the difference between black and white, or whether he just has to read law books or be an accountant. It doesn't seem to make a... Although it seems like to me that historically, I guess it's only because I want to remember what I believe, that successful people, it seems like to me, know something about what they're a success in. I wonder if that's right. They certainly do after they get there. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if it's right that that's what is the path.
You made a comment earlier that a number of other people have said too, which relates to luck.
Yeah.
That's not the major part of it, but it plays a role certain in being at the right place at the right time.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
This kinds of stuff let people get by luck or chance unwittingly. It has to do with good work ethic and believing that honesty is a good thing, and keeping their nose to the grindstone instead of finding good excuses not to go to work next Thursday. I think that those are things that prevail probably no matter whether you're a good lawyer or a good salesman or something else, don't you?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And this seems to be a trademark of Mallinckrodt. Integrity, honesty,
yeah,
a good work ethic.
I wonder if it isn't a trademark of any successful situation. You don't find crooks getting along and for long, mm-hmm. I guess. On the other hand, you can have all these high integrity, good sounding things and not wind up very well either.
Do you think that this integrity characteristic of Mallinckrodt was instilled by both Edward and his father?
Yeah.
The idea that he didn't want to sell because he really wanted to keep his independence.
He didn't want to sell because he was scared, I think. And I think he was really unwittingly, maybe because he was scared, he wanted to preserve what his father gave him and not lose it.
Okay. And that's why he didn't want it, he didn't work on growing it. Because when you
everything that I wanted to do, after I got to know him, to grow it, I knew he was happy with. He used to tell stories about me around town that once in a while would come back to me. And he was happy with what he had. But why the hell he didn't get it 40 years earlier is too bad for society. And what the hell, if I'd have been brighter, maybe I could have been another Merck. But we got a late start, by 20 years or more. That's an excuse I'm giving, you understand?
No, but your record was still a good record. The growth was phenomenal during your time. I have a quote here attributed to you. One of the principal challenges to management is to avoid being surprised.
Well, I'm a sure believer in that.
Did you have surprises?
Yeah, I learned that. I mean, we established a thing finally called the Holds Committee. You ever hear that?
I've read about it, yes.
And what that meant was to avoid surprises and to plug the holes before they got to be big, or to detect holes and set up accounting controls that would let you know gradually when something's going bad, maybe. And that was around the thought that let's not have surprises. A major surprise we had was something awful dumb that we did. Awful dumb. You referred to Columbia Montana a minute ago. We were the largest producers of something. I'd forgotten whether it was Columbia, maybe it was both Columbia Montana and products for a company called National Research in Boston. And this is run by a guy who was a couple of years ahead of me in school, a fellow named Dick Morris. Anyway, it was one of these materials, tantalum, let's say. And we became the largest importer of tantalum in the United States, unfortunately, for about 6 months or a year. Oh, this was so dumb. This was about the third year I was president of Mallinckrodt. And the guy that did this, and I knew what was going on, made a contract with some big-time metal people in New York. Some big name I forgot, but you remember it. You heard of it. And we contracted for a big stuff that we thought we were going to need for this outfit in Boston, National Research. And I'll be damned if they didn't finally decide that they didn't want it. And we got this stuff at $10 a pound or some big number, and it was worth $3. And little old Mallinckrodt in 1962 or 63 cost $1.25 million or something, which was almost all of our profit for the year. Oh, this was so dumb. And well, we did it. But one of the things that I wanted to do was, we're going to write it off, don't hide it, tell the world we did it. And we came out finally. It didn't suffer much, except we lost the money. But the stock kept going up. But some things are awful dumb that people do, and that was one of them.
Didn't you also have Penn Central stock? Wasn't that another?
Yeah, but that's clearly enough, because of the smart financial fellow we had that I referred to a minute ago. We bought $1 million, so we're $2,500. I think this is right. My recollection is $2,500,000. What do they call those things that companies sold, which were just like certificates of deposits? Companies could sell them. Anyway, we bought $1 million worth, as I remember. And oh, this was awful. Penn Central failed. There was a director from a big time New York operation, financial underwriters. What the hell were their names? Started with G, and there were two names in it. I shouldn't repeat this, I guess. And there was a director from Kuhn Loeb, or it wasn't Kuhn Loeb, but it was somebody, on the board of Penn Central. And he went to a director's meeting on the 28th of April, that wouldn't make any sense, March, let's say, that Penn Central was going to be in god-awful trouble. And this brokerage outfit, he went back and wrote a note, which our lawyers found in this company's files, that said, dump all these things. So we bought ours on the 29th, after this note had been sent around his organization. Big time, honest guys, you know, integrity all well. And we bought it, and then it failed. And we sued them. And of course, it's the discovery procedure and the suit. Say, should you be going?
No, I'm fine.
And in the course of this discovery procedure, we found that note and other items that were, nothing as condemning as that. And what do you know? Before the trial, the head guy of that outfit, he's not called the president of brokerage and the underwriting operations, came out and talked to this fellow, this smart guy named, his name was Brenner, the financial fellow at Mallinckrodt, and said he wanted to have us withdraw the suit and he'd pay us so much. And we told him no. And then he offered some more money, and I think it was maybe as much as $700,000 or $800,000 of the million. I don't know where the hell he got that, but and we took it, and this financial fellow from Mallinckrodt said, and we want the stock in Penn Central along with us. So the hope was that something good would happen. And I'll be damned, the stock did turn out good. And we got about $1.25 million back from our $1 million. But that was a whole, this is such an awful thing for a company to get caught in that trap. And in Wall Street, they live on integrity and honesty and all wool and yard wideness. And here was that guy coming, sitting down and... I've never understood the discovery procedure of lawyers. I should think before anybody came around to go through your files, you'd go through them yourself and wouldn't leave notes in about dump this stuff, because the companies, they didn't fail, did they? Do you remember this situation? Or maybe they reorganized and their stock became worth something later on.
You mean Penn Central?
Yeah.
Well, they don't exist. Well, I think there's a holding corporation somewhere with that name, but I think that's all. I think Conrail eventually took over all of that. We talked about your acquisitions. That was really, I have here, there were three things that you wanted to do when you started out. One was decentralization, so you set up, right. We talked about that. The second was acquisitions. We've talked about some of that. And the third part was going international. Was that your emphasis?
Oh, yeah. This fellow who was interested in narcotics, that I referred to, his name was Holmeyer. And I've forgotten how this started. We wanted a guy to... He had been sort of like an executive officer to a guy named Anslinger, who was the first commissioner of narcotics in the United States sometime in the 20s or early 30s. And he used to take a trip with Anslinger to go to one of these international narcotics meetings. And he was the only guy in the company that had been outside North America. A couple of us had been to Canada. So he figured Gus should take over this job. And Gus is the guy that made the arrangements with the Germans to handle farm radio pharmaceuticals and this material called Conray. And then the same thing went on in Japan. And out of that came, for our size at least, a substantial growth point of the company. And the name Mallinckrodt, for God's sakes, was astonishing. Of course, it's a German name, and whether they knew this Mallinckrodt or not, it didn't make any difference. It sounded... But Mallinckrodt was known all over, a lot more than you'd ever say a company that size would be. Gee, that's another thing that's coming up now is DeGatt. That's going to be the beginning of a giant world two-class society, I think, the haves and the have-nots. And it's going to be a dog-eat-dog thing with who makes what kind of goods the cheapest. And I think that's a hell of a good thing. But it's also a thing that's going to be a real basic variable in international trade and world survival. If you don't make it good and cheap, you're not going to be in business. And the United States, in one sense, it seems like to me, could be called of having had a subsidy of international business down through 40 or 50 or 60 years, when we made stuff, probably through creation, that other countries were willing to pay for. And they were new and novel, and we were great at it. And now people can do the same thing and do it cheaper. And we're getting hurt, and we're going to get hurt worse. And there's a company in St. Louis called Kelwood, and the fellow who really built that company is a pretty good friend of mine, and they make men's shirts, among other things. And they had a plant in Sri Lanka. That's an island off India someplace, isn't it? And they built a shirt factory there and paid the women something like 28 cents an hour instead of $3 or whatever they got in the United States a few years ago. And they would get shirts landed in the country. It's something like $1.80 a piece. And I said, what becomes of all the waste? Well, he says, that's in $1.80. They aren't as efficient as the United States people, but you can put up with a lot of inefficiency for the difference between 28 cents an hour, 10 times that. And this is going to happen all over, all products. The place where great, I guess, still is in agriculture products, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Also very active in community involvement, and you felt that you encouraged company employees also to be active in community affairs. That,
yeah. After Rachel, I was very active in that. This used to bother Mr. Mallinckrodt. He says, "You're doing enough pro bono." Is that the word? Mm-hmm. And then he'd read in the paper that I was head of the United Way or something, and I'm not sure why I did that, but I liked it very much, and I guess liked the activity and the spirit of accomplishment when you run a United Way organization and the Boy Scouts that works and people get some benefits from it. And I was very active around town and lots of things. I also got to be a director of a number of companies that was a good experience. It probably helped Mallinckrodt. I like to think it did because I spent time in these group of activities.
The Mallinckrodts were somewhat philanthropic here in the
very
state.
Very. They built a Mallinckrodt Institute of Radiology here, which is a world leader in X-ray diagnostic stuff and treatment. They gave, for the time, I guess it was in the 20s, a chemical laboratory to Harvard University.
Sure.
And they always participated in, I think Mr. Mallinckrodt Sr., who died in 1927, was more of a real philanthropist and a student of the subject than the Mr. Mallinckrodt that I know. But he himself did a lot. He left for the monitor at the time, when he died, $50 million to Harvard and $25 million to Washington University. See, that's another measure that the companies changed. When he died, in 1960, the company had 500,000 shares of stock at $30 a share. Mm-hmm. That's $15 million. And we sold this thing to Avon for $780 million or $770 million. And that's one obvious example of the change. And just in the short time, I don't know what the stock was worth if Mr. Mallinckrodt died, but the $75 million that he gave, I've forgotten the numbers, to Harvard and Washington University in St. Louis, must have been worth eight or nine times what it would have been worth in 1960. And anyway, I was active around town in a lot of things.
Intrigued by the fact that he was critical of your doing that. So I'm assuming then that while he was philanthropic, he didn't participate in anything himself.
He'd never be a front man or an organizer or a leader or a semi-front man even.
We've talked about the Holes Committee. You also created something called the Office of the Chairman.
Well, that's just another thing that it's a smaller operating committee. We had a chairman and a vice chairman and a president of the company, the Office of the Chairman, and that the three of us were pretty close in everything that happened. And it gave total knowledge of the company to three people rather than one person. And the operating committee gave most of the same kind of thing to seven people rather than one person. I think it's a nice sounding situation. It sounds as though you knew what you were doing.
I'm not sure now if I have the dates right, when the patents expired on on the paraminophenol and other players got into the market for acetaminophen? And
well, right now, the situation is that this comes from Mallinckrodt people. I don't know how objective it is, but I guess it's true. Are by far world leaders in the manufacture of the material, and we have plants in Germany and England and Ireland, I guess, and a couple in the United States. The biggest one, I guess, is in Raleigh, North Carolina. And this is a phenomenon. You know, the English knew that what now has become Tylenol, that this was an analgesic, and it was successful in England, but nobody seemed to know much about it. And all of a sudden, when was this, the late as the 70s sometime?
Mm-hmm.
Up pops Bristol Myers and Johnson & Johnson with a product, and Johnson & Johnson is unbelievable what they've done. They pushed our largest narcotics customer for codeine was Burroughs Wellcome in the United States part of that empire. And they were used to have Emperin, and this was the biggest aspirin analgesic, or maybe the biggest analgesic there was. Along comes Tylenol, and there's practically no more Emperin.
Mm.
And Tylenol doesn't have, or at least didn't start out to have, the anti-inflammatory aspect of aspirin. But they're selling Tylenol now for, I guess, for arthritis or anything.
As you approached the end of the 70s, you were looking at retirement. Some question about your successor, and didn't you had someone leave the company at one point?
We looked around and hired a headhunter fellow, and we got one of the vice presidents of Grace named Claybo that was here about a year, and I think it was only a year, maybe two, and he was not it's a lousy thing to say, I guess, but a Mallinckrodt kind of guy. He was more of a flamboyant what the hell was his favorite expression? Rather than prepare a hell of a presentation for financial analysts, he would, what the hell was his expression, not off the cuff, but he would go to a meeting, I guess he would tell me one or two and do this, and would say things that were sounded good, but if somebody started to grill him, he'd lose face. And then he seemed to want to, and I don't know, this is probably my doing, he wanted to come in and had nothing to do with anybody historically at Mallinckrodt, like me or this financial fellow. He wanted to take over everything from day one himself. And I guess that was a subjective reaction on my part, that was a lousy way to run a transition. So then we wound up with Bentelli, the fellow who was the Brenner's assistant, or Brenner's second in command. And then when Mallinckrodt got sold to Avon, the first mistake they got made was Avon paid too much money for Mallinckrodt. And they just, the head guy came out here after the purchase and gave a talk to the Mallinckrodt employees, said, "You people got a wonderful record. We don't know anything about the chemical and the pharmaceutical business, and we don't plan to learn. And you guys just carry on; it'll be great." Well, that's a foolish, or a fool's talk. And if I pay $20 for something, I'd want to know what's going on. $770 million. And then a fellow became chairman of the board of Avon. And I've forgotten his name. I never knew him very well, although he used to sit right across from me. I was a director of Avon for 12 or 15 months. And he was not a good guy there either. He didn't stay long. But anyway, he damn near wrecked Mallinckrodt in the process and was planning to sell off pieces of it because that was a fashion at the time, maybe in the early 80s. And Bentelli did a great job on the board there, at least keeping Mallinckrodt from getting sold piecemeal and having it sold as a unit. And then it was bought by IM&C in Chicago. A fellow named Kennedy was running IM&C. You're familiar with this, I guess.
Earlier, before Avon, there was National Distillers made a move, and you told the stockholders that you wanted to continue the independence of the company. I have a quote here somewhere. You argued that survival as an independent entity depended on its future. That was earlier. But you did want to maintain the company's independence rather than a hostile takeover.
I don't know how much of a, there were some, I think it's what my recollection is, that some other companies had shown some interest in it. This guy from National Distillers, I thought, had a lot of nerve. He bought, it seemed like a lot of money in those days. It doesn't sound like much now. It couldn't have been $25 million. Maybe it was $5 million worth of, I don't know. And he came out here and talked to this, and nothing came of that, but he made a lot of money on the stock that he bought. But selling Mallinckrodt to Avon, I believe, was a damn good thing for the stockholders. I'm not sure it was, I don't know who got hurt in the deal except Avon. But there was no doubt of it being a good thing for the stockholders. If it hadn't been sold, I assume that somebody would have found a way to take it over. And I think that as things have turned out, which certainly weren't planned, it's a better situation than if somebody had come in and taken it over. But who the hell knows?
Was Benatil involved with the takeover, or were you playing a role in that?
He and I were doing it. And there were lots of things involved. The company had to be run in the meantime when it was being taken over, or talks were going on, and those had to be handled. And then there was lawyers that got into the deal, and then we sort of parceled out the different activities, and I was on a board of Avon for 12 or 15 months after they bought it, and I guess he was on it until I got sold to Kennedy to IM&C. That guy had a lot of nerve at IM&C. You familiar with that?
I know just a little bit about it.
He was in this commodity business at IM&C, fertilizers for the agricultural world. And that's not a very spectacular business. And he had the guts to buy this thing from Avon by borrowing a lot of money and selling half of IM&C, I think, first. And since then, and fairly recently, within the last couple of years, I guess, all of IM&C has been sold to the public, and now IM&C was all the profits came from Mallinckrodt, so
the fellows like Ray Holman, who's now chairman of the board, changed the name back to Mallinckrodt and moved it to St. Louis, which is a nice thing for the community and for the people.
In your 40th anniversary with Mallinckrodt in 1979, and I was going to ask you if we might be able to get a copy of this. Each guest received a pamphlet titled A Short Chronicle of Your Contributions to Mallinckrodt. And if somewhere along the line we might be able to get a copy of that, it would be appreciated.
Okay, I saw one of those the other day.
But I'm now quoting, in less than two decades, Thayer had rekindled in Mallinckrodt the spirit of determination, persistence, and performance that characterized the company in its earlier days. His cultural revolution has succeeded. I was intrigued by that comment. And you had preserved and enhanced Mallinckrodt's values of quality, integrity, and innovation.
Sounds great. Who said that?
It's in the company history. The 125th history.
You know the fellow who ran that? That's called...
The History Factory?
Yeah.
I don't know anything about it.
God, what an eager beaver he is. Let me see. If you want one of those, I'll... I'll find one. Have you got a card here that I can keep, so I can keep track of the...
Sure, what I did with it.
How is this organization run on, by contributions of people or by the regular of the chemical industries?
It's a combination of contributions from individuals. We have industrial support, number of companies and foundation support, American Chemical Society, AICHE, and then grants for special projects from... We had Mellon Foundation money for a project, Pew Foundation money. This project being supported by the contributions from the Society of Chemical Industry.
Was your talk of Monsanto, did he mention Hochwald and these things? That
No, we didn't talk about Hochwald at all.
Now, they had another product there, an agricultural product that's great.
Lasso.
Yeah.
Yes. Let me just finish up with a few things. We've covered most of my original agenda, but one of the things I noticed when you gave your talk, when you received the chemistry industry medal, was that you focused on the government regulation. What changes have you seen since that time?
Well, I was bitching. But good God, it's increased so much since then. I don't know. It's awful hard to know what's right and wrong. But I heard a discussion on television a week ago Sunday, I think. Five governors of five states that had tried a lot of original ways to cut down their budgets and do good things with welfare and one thing and another, and they've been very successful, I guess, and maybe that's why they got elected again.
just thought it was awful what the federal government does to the states. And I guess the same story can be made for what federal government does to the EPA rules and to anything else they tamper with, which is most everything. And these are very complicated subjects, so when you talk about education, for example, it seems like to me that you've got to have somebody, some group, looking at all the citizens. Now, they can't run every school board in every state, but it seems like to me they can't leave it up to the citizens of Nebraska to teach only how to raise wheat. And the requirements of the states are so different that if you don't have something imposed on them to teach them how to read and write, that's bad. This is taking an absurd extremity here. But when they get too tight, that's bad. And I don't know what too tight really is, but to hear these governors talk, there's no doubt about it that at least when I heard it, I guess it's all true, that they were much able to do better with less money on the subjects that they were talking about, one of which was welfare, than the federal government does. And geez, you get... The first thing that happens when a new law gets passed, I facetiously say, up goes a new 20-story building in Washington to run it. And Washington's got to have some control out of the country this big and this complicated, I think. Or else you don't... You have so much difference of opinion of what's good for Arizona and what's good for the people of Rhode Island. But you can't go too far with it, or you get 24-story buildings and no action. But the education is, good God, my favorite semi-facetious remark is, they teach basket weaving instead of reading and writing. And this, I don't know, it just seems awful to him, but I suppose the guy that started that figured it was great, and he sold it to a lot of people. You must have pretty good feelings on this subject, having gotten a PhD. Yes. What was your PhD in?
Chemistry.
Geez, that's a pretty disciplined, highly disciplined field. Mm-hmm.
I had a question and I lost it. In terms of, I know what it was. Bill Wishnick of Whitco Chemical told me that his father, who founded the company, who came in to do something in the office till the day he died in his late 80s, in his later years complained to his son. He said, "You've got all these lawyers and all these environmental people." He said, "They're not selling anything. They're non-productive people in terms of the product of the company, all brought on by government regulation." Was that true also with Mallinckrodt? Did you have to bring in?
Sure. Of course, when I was more closely involved with that in the middle 70s, it was just a mild dose of what's going on now. One of the things that always amazed me was that a guy, remember they used to have quotas for something, people, I guess. It couldn't have been, it was back in the days when you could keep track of whether a fellow was black or white, and they would set quotas up. And a guy that was a perfectly normal person would be representing the government, and all of a sudden he would be a philosophical picture. A correct, bright philosophical picture of what the government wanted and pushed the hell out of you. And I always wondered how he got so many converts. Maybe they weren't converts, it was just a job and that's what they did.
Yeah, they many of them are very, it's almost a religious fervor with them, so
yep.
The way they do that.
The airlines have gotten into a pickle on the other side of the subject, it looks like to me.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't know what was good for themselves. Where's this fellow who did that? He's a professor at Harvard now, is he? The fellow who masterminded the deregulation of the airlines?
Yes, I don't know where he's at.
but awful abuses go on too. That Jesus, this guy, not Miller, Milken.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the bastard's got $600 million left, I guess, now after spending a year and a half in jail, and he must have screwed a lot of people. These seem awful things to me.
Yes, you wonder why that the people who were. There can't be some kind of retribution after.
Yeah.
Let me ask you one more question. We've been talking about innovation, research and development in some respects throughout the afternoon. What do you think is important for the future of chemical innovation, research and development?
I mean, it's a dumb thing to say with bright people, but there's so many things I wonder. I don't know. It looks like to me as though there's so much decompartmentalization of knowledge now. Some guy gets to be an authority on some little piece of chemistry, and another guy over here. How do you keep these things together? This must be an important thing to help answer your query. How do people knit together all the things that are useful to them to studying a particular problem? This is tough. I would think it would be awful tough. And how you, I guess what you're really talking about, and they give courses in school, don't they, on this subject of how to stimulate imagination and I guess there's no answer to this, is there?
Well, there's no easy solution, obviously. But
I guess with people that have this ability to imagine and create, ought to be left alone.
Okay.
And nobody should tamper with them or they'll screw them up.
Okay.
That's Bill Danforth's definition. Let them do their thing.
And what? This is a standard question I'm asking of everyone. What did it mean to you when you won the SCI medal? The Society of Chemical Industry.
Of course, I was proud as hell.
Okay.
I wonder what else I can say that's meaningful. You become part of a kind of eliteness that is very satisfying. What's your normal answer?
Most people said it hasn't meant anything. And which is a surprising answer. I never expected that answer. And you and John France on the other day, the first two people who felt differently than that. So.
Well, the people that give you those answers got a string of 30 medals, maybe they've won?
Some have others.
Oh, maybe that's.
John made the point that for a researcher, a person who spent his entire career doing research rather than moving into administrative responsibilities, there are very few rewards and recognitions. And so when they come from your peers as the Perkin Medal or the SCI Medal, then that has considerable meaning.
Yeah, it must be true what you just said, though, because unless a guy gets a Nobel Prize, these scientific things are talked about in the newspapers all so often that it's got to be really something. And a patent never gets any publicity. And then also I think that things are getting so complicated. We read about the genome project. And about the biochemical business and Amgen coming along and Genentech. Mm-hmm. And they're all such complicated things just in themselves that it's hard to understand what they may mean. So if a scientist is involved in any one of those things, it's such a big job, a big scope of activity, that it's hard to get any recognition for it. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's the trouble.
Well, is there anything else you would like to add that I haven't covered?
I don't think so. I think that you must have done a lot of homework before you got here.
Well, I did a little bit.
I'm reminded of a number of things because of it that I never would have thought of. I don't think of this anything.
Okay. Well, when you see the transcript, if there's anything else you might want to add.
Probably amount to a lot of pages, but a lot of stuff that are O's and I's, huh?
No, I appreciate your time very much. Thank you for spending the afternoon with me.
It's been very nice to somebody who's covered the scope of things.
And that's going to come very fast.
You know, when I first came out here, it was 50 years ago, the country was probably only 125 million people, wasn't it? And right in front of our eyes, it's doubled.
I remember we said we wouldn't hit 200 million until the turn of the century.
And now we're 225 or something,
yes.
250.
I have one other brief matter here. We have a standard release form. Which is self-explanatory.
What does it say?
Well, basically it says that you certified you've been interviewed, that we will transcribe this and make it available to you, and then you will have the opportunity to request restrictions on access and so on. And
when does this happen, do you suppose?
When you get the transcript?
I mean, I do that to be 2 weeks or 2 years or...
Well, I'm hoping it will be within a couple months.
How many of these do you want at the same time?
Well, this series of interviews is going to be about 40 interviews. So it's quite a project. You're number 7, I think. So
where else would it be?
Oh. I appreciate you spending the time with me today.
Yeah, you know, I just think there'd be a common thread of something that runs through them.
That's what I'm looking for. And
I don't know whether it's the characteristics of the situation or the people or the industry or geography or philosophy or what.
I think a lot of it, from what I've seen so far, a lot of it is individual personality that makes something like this fit.
And that has to fit at the time, I
think. That's right. It has to.
You've got to lose it.
That's right.
Like this business of a manager to manager.
When I was chairman of our chemistry department and looking for people to hire and interviewing people, we had a department of 6 or 7 people in a liberal arts setting. And one of the things I always looked for was how they would fit with the rest of the department.
they could have had brilliant chemistry now, but if I didn't feel they were going to fit properly with the rest of the people in the department, it was not going to be a good situation. And they might have fit perfectly in another situation. I wanted to fit with ours because you didn't need somebody to come in and be divisive or upsetting, and you wanted to contribute. And I'm not saying I had to fit the mold, but I've seen situations where people come in and can destroy the organization rather than help build it. And some of that, another thing that's showing up is that people talk about having an intuition and gut feeling. I've heard that term several times. It's amazing that they use in making decisions, which turned out to be very good ones.
Well, I suppose this happens to everybody in all situations. Somebody uses a gut, and maybe it's spectacular kind of thing. But in most decisions that people make, just where they turn on the street, they're almost automatic. Mm-hmm. When you get it, I would think that the gut is a good word. It sounds spectacular. But most people, I think, analyze the hell out of important subjects as best they can, and maybe finally get a balance if somebody has to decide something. But it's nice to feel at least the fact that a lot of rule is different. It's not a crafty.
No, it's more than that, but let's say there's a chemical intuition someone has. A project is going to succeed even though at the moment it doesn't look that promising. There's a very famous story of Dow Chemical when they were working on styrene development in the 30s. And Lord Dow decided that the plastic they were going to work on would be cellulosic plastic rather than styrene plastic. And he gave the order to stop working on styrene. One of the people on the project went to the company controller and he said, "I know this is going to work, we just need a little more time." And the controller said, "I have my orders, I have to close the account. What you do is give me another name and I'll open a new account in the other name." And Lord Dow never knew. And of course they went on to become the leader in styrene technology. And,
hey, what's happened to that company anyway? It used to be a creator, a world builder, and what happened to him?